Hey listener, Supriya here. Before you jump into the episode, I just want to warn you of some potentially triggering material that you or someone around you, particularly a younger person, may find disturbing. Please proceed with caution, and I hope you enjoy this or some of our other episodes.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Lit Pickers, a podcast on books and reading, with me, Dipanjana, who is sitting with her friend,
Supriya. Hello, Dipanjana.
Hello, Supriya. So you should all know that usually when we're recording in Bombay, we're not sitting opposite each other somehow. Like, you know, there seems to be different geometries that we find in the tiny little studio that we sit in. Today, we're facing one another, which feels very right for what we want to talk about.
Yeah, this has the quality of an interrogation.
Because today, Supriya and I will be spilling our guts. We're coming out with the confessions that we have never made before. The confessions of readers. The guiltiest things that we could not admit in the past, we are going to spill our guts about now.
Yeah, we've talked before about guilty pleasures and how we think there's no such thing and that you should read what you want to read. This isn't about that, dear listener. This is just about us telling you about the things that we lie about in literary terms.
Because the fact of the matter is that guilty pleasures, as Supriya mentioned, are just pleasures. There's no reason to feel any guilt about them. When it comes to lying, on the other hand.
Okay. Yeah. I think I've told our listeners before about the time that I wrote an entire exam essay on Ulysses without having read it.
This is my favorite story of yours, by the way.
And I did okay, I gotta say. You guys are talking to a first-class pass here.
Yoo-hoo! Okay,
a feat never to be repeated again in my professional or intellectual life.
But that's because you were not having to write answers on someone that, you know, only every single male has written about and published practically.
You're not wrong about that. But, you know, there are other darker confessions I have to make about people I pretend to read sometimes on a daily basis, and then I just never do. Like, you will be amazed by how often and enthusiastically I can bring up Shakespeare's Henriade in conversation. And look, it's a great cycle of plays, right? Like, those two Richards, Henry IV, both parts, Henry V, amazing. But I'll be honest with you. There is also a three-part play about Henry VI in that cycle, and I have never read one single line of those plays. If you ask me who Henry VI was, I have no idea. I'll just have to make things up.
I don't think anyone has actually read those plays, unless they were part of the RSC and had to perform them.
Listen, I think Shakespeare scholars will really, really dislike us for saying that.
I don't think they've read those plays either, but...
And I don't think they listen to the Lit Pickers.
They should.
Which is their problem.
So it's very funny to hear you say that, because here's the thing, right? Like, one of my confessions that I have to make is that I can't read plays. I have to read them out. For example, it took me a whole week to finish Richard II, which is not a very long play, by the way.
That's right.
It took me a whole week because I had to find places where I could declaim these dialogues.
These words.
I can't read them. Like, when I read a play, it's not just Shakespeare, to be fair. Any play.
Even modern plays.
Modern, ancient, like from Aeschylus to Martin McDonagh, which is as recent as I've read of plays.
Out loud.
Literally. I have to read it out loud. I have fallen asleep, like, in the middle of Hamlet. And that's not Shakespeare's problem, actually.
Good night, sweet princess.
Yeah, it's like, doof. Why? Because she's reading it and not reading it out loud.
I do think that audiobooks and radio dramas are great ways to really get stuck into plays. I mean, not to be like precious about this. I know everyone is like very precious about Shakespeare in ways that put, you know, younger readers off him immediately. But it does actually sound great and possibly sounds greater in declamation than it does when you're reading it on the page.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, particularly with Shakespeare and with some playwrights, Tom Stoppard, for example, they're really written with speech in mind. You know, like, there's a rhythm that builds up and there's a cadence to each word there's a sonic effect of each word. And when you hear it, it really just works so beautifully. In case of Shakespeare, the line breaks, the punctuation is so good, because what we're getting today as text is the result of performance texts, right? This is written to enable an actor to fulfill the potential of the text to its maximum. And we forget that. So yeah. If you're just going to blindly just follow the punctuation, try reading out Shakespeare. It works so beautifully. It's liquid.
Yeah. I also think Shakespeare in accents that are not British RP.
Amazing.
Just work so much better, and are perhaps, you know, I think our colonial accents are perhaps closer to what the English of Shakespeare's time sounded
possibly.
Also, what we hear on the BBC today.
Also, why does it even matter?
It does not matter.
You know, like, I don't need to have heard Shakespeare the way it was done in the Shakespearean era. Some things are good changed. But Royal Shakespeare Company has taken some very sort of, you know, definitive decisions to do colorblind casting, for example, gender-blind casting.
A sort of age-blind casting, as we saw when Ian McKellen made headlines around the world for playing Hamlet.
Yes.
Famously considered, you know, a very young role for young people.
Yeah. They also did, I'm forgetting which play it was now of Shakespeare's, because this was during the pandemic era when in 2020, a lot of people were putting up past productions to watch online for free. And now it's become a bit of a blur for me. But one of the actors was a deaf-mute actor. So they were doing everything in sign language. They were performing in sign language. Mm-hmm. And I didn't actually feel the loss because they adapted things really well. If you're looking to be inclusive, theatre is something that will let you do it because it is an audio and visual medium.
That's
but when
true.
It comes to the writing in terms of dialogues and stuff, I really think that being able to speak it out just adds a layer to it. But that doesn't take away from the fact that you can read it.
I will say that one class of people who should not be included in the theatre are bad actors. Because as you were speaking, I just remembered like another real L I took in college.
Hmm.
Actually, the Joyce faking was a W, right? But this was a real L. I was cast in a production of Riders to the Sea, the famous one-act Irish play by J.M. Synge about like really miserable fisher folk on the Irish coast. And I played the lead role of Moria, maybe the worst Moria anyone has ever been in the history of this play.
I have trouble believing this, but
it was so bad.
Really?
So bad. Being like really dramatic IRL has absolutely nothing to do with how well you act. Let me take this confessional episode as a moment to apologize to anyone who had to like watch that or act with me.
Something that I've lied about regularly, mostly because I'm amongst a group of extremely intelligent people who are sounding even more intelligent than they actually are. And they will throw in names like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Pushkin and Chekhov. And I will nod very, very somberly and knowingly, despite the fact that I have not read a single Russian, except for Nabokov.
Right.
This
Who
is
an American.
He became an American.
That's right.
But so as my dad once pointed out to me, doesn't count. But yeah, I don't know what it is. I have tried, but the Russians put me to sleep. I've watched Chekhov.
Hmm.
And they were very good performances, in fact.
Did you enjoy the plays?
More or less. But that's more about the performance, I think, than the text. Except, you know, I'd have had to read the text to be able to comment about them.
That's true. It's funny how these blinkers exist for us, right? I don't think anyone you meet would ever say that you were anything but extremely well-read. It's just a fact.
In many ways, I am.
Yeah. It's not a value judgment. You are just someone who's read a hell of a lot. But it just so happens that this part of literary history has just fallen like between two stools, the French and the British. The Russians just like sank.
And you know what the really weird part is? That there's
what Napoleon could not do to the Russians,
have done with my mind.
You just sidelined them.
I have read so much non-fiction on the Russians, though.
Oh, tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, basically the collected works of Simon Sebag Montefiore.
Yes, the person who is most recently responsible for reintroducing to the world the fact that Stalin was really, really hot.
He was such a hottie. And sang beautifully, apparently, which is how he sort of caught someone's eye and was taken into the seminary to learn Russian. And if that had not happened,
then,
well, he would just have been a farmer in Georgia.
The songbird of Georgia would never have become the... Anyway, moving on. Moving on before our communist listeners storm the studio.
The thing with communism is that one of the major reasons I really think that it caught on is how hot the men and women evangelizing for it were.
Yeah.
Leaving their hotness aside, there's a whole lot of nonfiction like Catherine the Great, the history of that period. Mm. She's an amazing figure.
She is, yeah. Confession, although this should probably be for like the TV pickers, you know, that other podcast that we're not doing. I tried to watch The Great and I thought it didn't work for me.
So I really enjoyed the first few episodes when I thought it was not trying to be a historically rooted show in any way, but was just going off into a flight of fancy. The moment you keep the history in mind, it's actually a really troubling show because it reduces Catherine into even more of a caricature, I feel. Like, Catherine the Great got terribly bowdlerized, basically, by the British press, actually, because the British press was acting on the anxieties of greater Russian influence over European politics. Catherine the Great being incredibly charismatic, but also one of the imperialist rulers of Russia. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that the nonfiction part of things, I have lapped up. The fiction, though, and here's the thing, right, that certain kinds of literature have an aura of intelligence around them. Russian literature is one of them because, you know, from all accounts, these writers like Dostoevsky, like Tolstoy and Bulgakov and all of these guys, they're supposed to have great insights and amazing style, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just like,
You're like, agree.
Yeah. Check. It's like, whatever you say.
You know, this probably sounded a chord with many listeners. To me, the thing about the great classicists is that they kind of created the modernity that we live in, right? So even if you haven't read Dostoevsky, you are a product of Dostoevsky in some way.
That makes me feel much better.
And so maybe that's just all there is to it. The 19th century is one thing that I haven't lied about often, as often as other things. But, you know, like I haven't read Anthony Trollope.
Oh, Thomas Pynchon. That's another one. I've not read.
I've also not read. It would be nice to read Pynchon. I don't know if people lie about not having read David Foster Wallace. I haven't read any of his fiction and I wouldn't lie about it, would you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's also modern authors. There's less of a pressure in that sense to be aware of them unless they have become somewhat important in a global zeitgeist. But there are very few authors that command that kind of heft. Like off the top of my head, I can't think of a writer if you said that I haven't read X, people would judge you.
Arundhati Roy.
Abroad? No. I mean, it's just not expected.
That's fair.
I'm sure there's like incredibly important Nigerian writers that I know nothing about, and they are very important in that world. And we've become more aware of that in the contemporary era.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're looking at what we consider sort of pre-war English literature, it's a very small circle of writers, actually, if you think about it. So then the pressure of knowing those works of literature from whether it's English or it's France or it's Russia or wherever it is, the circle seems smaller because the canon has been built around them and that's just been sort of passed down for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. And there's so much moral weight attached to the writers you should be reading, whether they're from the past or from the present, that sometimes it can get a bit embarrassing to confess that, you know, you really like writers who would not make it to anybody's moral canon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I feel like as an Indian, there's something strange about recognizing how great Rudyard Kipling is. But I'm sorry, guys, he's really great. That's my confession. I like Rudyard Kipling.
What's your favorite Kipling?
Solid. I read The Jungle Book as a child and it blew my mind how good the book is. Especially in comparison to the Disney cartoon, which those of us of a certain vintage remember, it was no mean thing. You know, I mean, it gave us like that really catchy title song.
Bare Necessities and the King Louis character.
Oh, sorry. I was not thinking of Bare Necessities. I was thinking of the Chaddi Pehen Ke Phool Khilaye.
Okay, then.
On the DD show and great animation and all of that. But trust me, if you have a child in your life, or even if it's just for your inner child, highly recommend bringing the book home just to see how magical the world that Kipling creates is. And one of my pandemic era reads was Kim, which should rightfully horrify people reading it today for its orientalism.
It is an orientalist masterpiece, but it's also a masterful travelogue.
It's so good. Oh my God, when like Kim has to leave the monk and go to school, I cried. It was so fantastic. He really swept me along.
Yeah. And those descriptions of the road and the travel.
The Swathi Pathans.
Yeah.
I did read that and think, man, I'm understanding so much about stereotypes that have persisted in the subcontinent and beyond to this day.
There's also Kipling's Just So stories, which were very charming to me as a child.
So good.
I don't know whether they would, you know, make the cut today because they do anthropomorphize animals and things like that.
Are we not good with that anymore?
There's a certain school of thought that would encourage you to think of animals as not being like humans, but like being themselves. You know, like a rabbit has its own way of thinking.
Right. Or something that counts as the rabbit's form of thinking.
Yeah. It's like a rabbit should not have to be like a human for you to care about it. A rabbit should have the freedom to be a rabbit. Which is not to say Beatrix Potter did anything wrong by putting that coat on little Peter Rabbit, because that is just the cutest thing ever.
That's true. But don't enforce the idea that animals have to be cute or appealing to humans or even understandable to humans. That makes a lot of sense. Also, the thing about Kipling is that he's a great poet, right? I think most people know If, which is fine. Like, I think you should read If before you're 15. So that you can internalize it and then, you know, not be a fascist about it. Kipling was born in Bombay, right?
Yeah.
And can I read like a little quote from a poem he wrote called To the City of Bombay? Just so that you get a sense of what a swinging sense of rhythm he had. And this is him writing about the city. And she shall touch and remit after the use of kings, orderly, ancient, fit, my deep sea plunderings and purchase in all lands. And this we do for a sign. Her power is over mine, and mine I hold at her hands.
Aww.
Doesn't that just make you want to like get on a sailboat, bring home some cargo, do some capitalist plundering?
The relationship between a certain group of colonials and this country is so complicated. And our relationship as post-colonials with those people is equally complicated because some of this is just so beautiful. Like, Rudyard Kipling, you're talking about Lockwood Kipling equally, like his father. Some of the work that he did as an artist is stunning and effectively reducing India to an exotic stereotype.
Indeed.
It's worth keeping in mind that for these people, though, it's very likely that India was much more than a cliche to them. They did have lived experience in this country and they did love this country in a way that I don't think should be debated. It's just that the way that they saw the country is also very, very troubling because it's reductive, you know?
It's okay. We are here now. We will work against stereotype. And or better still, we will go to the West and write very stereotypical things
about the
them.
West. Yeah. Return the favor, as it were.
Give us a visa.
Or don't. Just read our stuff and give us your money. There's something very beautiful about Kipling's prose, undoubtedly, right? When we're talking about stylized writing, we have a really strong tradition of travelogue set in India. Mm-hmm. I don't think we would have it without Kipling. He wrote so beautifully about this country. And that stuff that anybody who has grown up with the English language in their school curriculum has had to read because of the imposition of the British canon. And I think it has a huge part to play in that. Especially if you grew up in India, then even more so.
We're weak against
this pen. What you were saying about, you know, troubling relationships, for me, that's with Pablo Neruda.
Tough one.
Really difficult because Neruda, for those of you who may not be familiar with his work, he was a Chilean poet.
And his poetry does to you what spring does to the cherry trees.
His love poetry is very well known because of films and stuff like that. But there's also like incredibly powerful efforts to talk about the common world, the everyday world, the indigenous life. So he wrote beautifully and he was well celebrated because he stood for all the things that he believed in ideologically. Being a leftist, he faced a fair amount of harassment, had to leave the country. So, you know, seems so heroic. And then Oh, and then he writes in his autobiography about raping a woman who was working as the cleaning staff in a hotel that he was staying in Sri Lanka.
He knows it's wrong, but he's also just so compelled by the narrative, yeah. I think, that he's figured out for his own life that he has to tell you about this crime he committed.
Also that he assumes that you will forgive him because he has been big enough to admit to it.
Yeah, this is a guy writing for readers who he thinks will understand his position. And yeah. He should be like, oh, yeah. If you're simpatico,
yeah.
You know, you will see why I did it. And maybe you're the kind of guy who would do it too.
And it just destroyed the image of Neruda for me in many ways.
It's also so hard to stack up the joy that someone's writing gives you against the knowledge that they have caused indescribable pain to someone.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like a poet, I find this very difficult to do with is Derek Walcott, who, like Neruda, is also, yes. I mean, he's no longer alive.
Yes.
So we're not talking about standing with the less powerful person in an ongoing conflict.
No,
we're talking
no.
about something historical, something yeah. that has happened in the past.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just really difficult to look at the page without remembering.
And I don't think we should.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think we should look at the page. And I think we should remember both the beauty of what is in that text on its own, but also the ugliness of the person who wrote it.
Yeah. I also think that people who have trouble actually reading or engaging with work after they have obtained knowledge of something horrendous about that person, I think it can be a little difficult to weigh that in the balance and wonder about whether you're thinking about this the right way or not. Are you being intellectually feeble? I think it's fine to be intellectually feeble in
100%.
That case. It's just, it's your taste and it's your character in the end that shapes who you are as a reader.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, the truth of the matter is there's just so much literature that you're not going to read everything and you will choose, inevitably. Everyone has, as it turns out, right? Nobody has read everything.
That's true.
So you're allowed to decide what informs you. You're allowed also, I think, by the same token, at least this is where I have arrived at with Neruda's poetry, I would like to hold on to the beauty. I would not like to forget the ugliness. I would like to remind myself that it is possible to be both, because that is the truth. Both do exist. The beauty of his poetry is not made ugly by what he was, even though he's the one who wrote it. And
yeah,
all of that.
And in some ways, I think it is the reader who makes the work beautiful. Again, that is between you and the page.
Yeah.
And we're talking about something entirely separate from canon making and intellectual knowledge production and all the give and take of capital, which is something much less personal than
no, this is an emotional connect
between you and this person you're reading.
And there's certain people who are able to write things that embed themselves into your life. Neruda is somebody who had the gift of being able to do that.
Yeah.
And if that happens with you and his work, then that is not a bad thing. It doesn't exonerate him in any way, but the work is still beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing is this, as we grow older, we realize that so many of the people we have looked up to in real life, sometimes our own family and friends, turn out to have feet of clay. And this process of learning how to deal with the fact that people we love tend to not be perfect and can in fact be people who have caused harm to us or to other people is like an ongoing real life problem.
Yeah.
And we owe it to the books we love and the writers who have shaped us to really wrestle with that too. Literature doesn't exist in a vacuum, just like you don't exist in a vacuum.
On that,
having said that,
yeah.
Tell me about something that you should actually be in jail for, like from
yes.
a literary perspective.
Let us lighten the mood a little bit. I confess, I am a book pilferer. It is true. There is nary a library that I have walked into.
You are a book thief.
I am a book thief.
You are the person Marcus Zusak was writing about.
No, tragically, I have not inspired any work of literature.
Much less a bestseller.
Or a bestseller, because man, would it be great to get some cuts from that. Mm. But no, there is nary a library I have walked into that I have not walked out of with a book illegally smuggled out. And for this, I lay the blame upon my dearly departed uncle.
In loving memory.
In loving memory, who pilfered his way through libraries across the country, saying with great cheer and gravitas that Saraswati cannot be stolen. She can only be shared. So, you know, whatever book that he felt was languishing in some library in some little town that he was in, he felt like the book was going to just get a better life with him. So he'd just walk out with the book. Which was great because, like, you know, you'd look at his bookshelf and they'd always have those library stickers, codes, which was quite hilarious. Yeah. For me, my most post-colonial moment, I think, so far was attempting to smuggle Edward Said's Orientalism out of the British Council Library in Delhi.
Just as he would like you to read it.
I think he would have appreciated that.
I completely agree. Now that you mention it, there are a couple of coils in my otherwise smooth brain that mm-hmm. have been burning red hot with shame for 20 years because I have been guilty of the same thing.
Mm.
Sometimes inadvertently in that sense of, you know, oh, my membership to this library has lapsed and I'm moving cities or whatever. Do you give a lot of books to libraries?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
I would like to believe that maybe some of that is atonement for these horrible things that we've done.
You know, I'd never thought of it, but it's possible. I mean, I'd never put the two together. But yeah, because the thing is that I have many books in duplicate, mostly because there will be different people who have given them to me sometimes. Sometimes I've ended up buying multiple editions because they're beautiful.
Mm.
But essentially, yeah, duplicates I will give. I never, ever give to libraries or for donation books that I don't like. That's not something that I will ever do.
Well, that's really lovely.
Yeah. Especially if I'm giving to a library, I will give books that I think will give somebody else joy. So they may not seem like serious books for a library necessarily.
Mm.
Sometimes they are because there's loads of nonfiction and stuff that I've given as well. But I do try to give a healthy dose of good fiction whenever I can. So,
And I hope those books are stolen by people who
I
really
hope
love
someone's
them too.
Stolen them. I hope they found happy homes and are wandering around the world.
To any librarians listening to this, what can we say? We're sorry.
Okay. Last confession. I judge books by covers.
I knew this was coming when you talked about buying multiple editions.
It just struck me, yeah. Have you never judged a book by cover?
I do frequently, but I have to say on this, I think we part ways because I can't put it aside. So much of my book reading is about compartmentalizing the book. They give you a hardback with like a beautiful jacket flap and I'm reading it and then within 30 pages I'm just like, I don't need this. And the jacket flap is like on the carpet.
It's true. This has happened a few times. But I would like to just state for the record that frequently this judging the book by the cover thing has worked out really well for me because it's meant that I have found books that I would not have found otherwise because I've literally just gone for the image.
Yeah.
Right?
It's true. I have sometimes bought books because of like the author photos. Like I would never have discovered the British author David Mitchell, who I think is now most famous for Cloud Atlas.
Mm.
If I hadn't been flipping through books at Denai Bookstore, late lamented, and opened the back flap of Number 9 Dream, which was a second novel, and then seen like a full page image of him and realized that he was like hot.
Was it black and white?
It was monochrome. It was like red and white.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing. Monochrome, generally though, black and white, it just makes everyone look so hot. So,
I mean, photographers have tried with me, I have to say, and it hasn't worked so well.
It has worked very well.
But the thing with David Mitchell is he's like a legit hottie.
Also, you don't need monochrome, my love. Technicolor's doing great things for you.
We are glowing goddesses. Anyone who looks at the Lit Pickers promotional material will be able to see.
Of course. But if you are a budding author or even an experienced author, take a photograph in monochrome. Because if you have a hot author photograph, chances are a critic like Supriya Nair will pick up your book. And then, I mean, what else can you ask for in life?
As a red-blooded teenager, that's all you need.
All you can ask for.
He turned out to be actually good, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't kept up with his latest work, but book after book was just a W after W.
Yeah, good stuff. And on that happy note, we're going to wind up today. Thank you for listening. This was The Lit Pickers. I'm Dipanjana.
And I am Supriya. And we have brought you this podcast about books and reading from the city of Bombay.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, Tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriyantha Panjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks. Keep listening.